hope this recorder is now working, but I don't guarantee this one is going to get recorded because I was having some problems having filled up the memory without realizing it. All right, let me start by talking about the material for your assignment for next week. At this point, the relevant three volumes of Maimonides are all on reserve in the library. All of the Mishnah, one big volume is on reserve in the library, and one volume of the Talmud, which is a volume that gets referred to a good deal in the relevant bits of Maimonides, is on reserve. And I'm probably after class going to pick up in the library a second volume of Talmud, and with luck I could manage to get a third, and that would cover all the things you'd be likely want to look at. In addition, if you've looked at the web page, you have hopefully noticed that I do not know what is going on with this thing, because it claims apparently that time is going down instead of up on this recording, which shouldn't be happening. So as I say, it may well be that I've what? Yeah, it may be. Well, we've got 3 hours and something to go according to this, so it's going to be a while. But I have not figured out what it is doing or whether it is recording, because the volume goes up, but it maybe it's recording. It's stuck onto the end of something else, and I'll have to disentangle it. I'll worry about that later. Anyway, so that stuff is there, and then if you've looked at the web page where I've got a link to the reading assignment, at this point, all of my suggested stuff, I have links to online sources you can use for it. No, you don't have to take any of my suggestions. That is, you are free to look through the three volumes of Maimonides that are on reserve, say, this chunk looks like fun to me, read 50 to 100 pages of it, whatever seems to sort of cover the what interests you, then go at the beginning of each of those three volumes. There are some notes by the translator about what parts of Mishnah different things are from, so with any luck you can find the corresponding part of the Mishnah, or I think there's an index to the Mishnah, find where it discusses divorce or whatever it is that interests you. Look at that part of the Mishnah. The Talmud has a one-to-one correspondence to the Mishnah. Let me, what I was thinking I ought to explain. Let these be three volumes. They're actually 11, 12, and 13, but I'm going to call it 1, 2, and 3 for the moment, of Maimonides. Let these be the various chunks the mission is divided into, which have some title that I've forgotten. And let this be Talmud similarly. What you will discover when you start looking at it is that one volume of Maimonides may in fact have material from, say, two different parts of Mishnah, and this part might also feed into this volume and this part and so forth. So that Maimonides has essentially gone through the law, organized as he thinks it ought to be organized by subject. Mishnah is sort of semi-organized by subject, so it tends to be that a part of Maimonides is largely from a particular part of the Mishnah, but not in fact. On the other hand, Mishnah and Talmud is absolutely one-to-one, because the titles, in fact, of the chapters, or whatever you call them, are the same, because the Talmud is embedded in the Mishnah. The Talmud is this part of the Talmud, consists of this part of the Mishnah, plus a whole lot of arguments about it, and so forth and so on. So that last step, y'all?
Unless there's links to everything listed here, does that mean we don't need to use the books in the library?
You don't need to if you want to do one of my suggestions. I think if you'll look, you'll see that at least one of those volumes, only 3 out of 5 sections of that volume are actually webbed. If you'll look, you'll see I've got sections 2, 3, and 4, I think is how I put it. So if you wanted to do 1 or 5, you would need the books. Or if you like having a physical piece of paper, notice also that one of the three volumes of Maimonides there, all I could find was a spoken text, not a written text. And that's a good deal less convenient from my standpoint, and I suspect from yours. So I think if you want, and I say that if you look on what it says on the
Mishnah Torah, Maimonides book, these are three sections, the book has all of them.
These are three volumes, that is, there are three volumes of Mishnah Torah, 11, 12, and 13, which, roughly speaking, correspond to modern law. Not exactly, but most of the rest of it is religious stuff of a very elaborate and potentially interesting stuff in terms of the argument, but not something which you would say, oh yes, the modern law about when you can plant two varieties of plants in the same field and how close they can be and so forth is, because we don't have modern law on that stuff, unless you stretch by analogy pretty far. There are things which are sort of analogous to things like when can an organic farmer object to somebody else using pesticide in the next field, but it's not in that form. But those three volumes are really about sort of, you know, tort law and criminal law and contract and that sort of stuff, which you're all familiar with. So each of those three volumes, that's why I only had three here. I say they're really actually 11, 12, 13. And each of those then has books within it. That is, it's one not very thick book, but it's organized as book one, book two, book three, or book one, two, three, four, and five. And if I remember correctly, I'd have to check, but I think two of these I found webbed written text, but in one of them it was all of it, and one of them was part of it. And the third I was only able to find a webbed spoken text. And my guess is that's all that's there, unless you read Hebrew, which I don't, and I assume you don't. There is, I think, more stuff that's webbed in the original. So therefore, I put in on reserve in the library all of those three volumes, and you may or may not find that a more convenient way of.
So the original isn't from, you went into like the Hebrew bookstore with, yes, like 12, 13 volumes.
I really don't know how that is commonly published. I know that what I've got is, I think, called the Yale edition, and it's an English translation, and I think it might be the only complete English translation, I'm not sure, at least that I found, and it's in the form of, I think, 13 volumes, 13 fairly, not fair number of pages, but a fairly small looking book, as you'll see, and I think I'm reasonably sure that they correspond to divisions in the original, but whether it was normally published as separate things, it may have been scrolls, after all, this is 12th century before the printing press, when the thing gets written, so I don't really know how it was physically done, but essentially you've got those 13 and then divisions within them. And the titles, I think, on the volumes are basically the translator's idea of how to sum up what it was about, like the Book of Civil Laws, for example. And they had titles in Hebrew, which he tells you about, which means something or other. But it won't be transparent to us.
Sorry,
yeah, sure. All right.
Have you read up at all about, like, Maimonides' position? Like, he was the...
He was physician.
Doctor to Saladin, right?
The dates are about right, but I'm not positive. That sounds right. He was the physician to some very important Islamic ruler, and it may have been Saladin, but I'm not positive if that's right or not. And he has an account somewhere of his own life, which sounds as though he's working himself to death, as though, you know, he's working 20 hours a day between being the physician to the Sultan and consulting with other people and doing his scholarly work and so forth. But I don't know a lot about him. I'm sure you can find online sort of biographical information about Maimonides. The main thing I knew about Maimonides is that when I got Maimonides, I finally had an account of Jewish law that was reasonably straightforward, you know, coherent, clear account. I would say probably a better account than I can find in the secondary sources, in the modern secondary sources. I will probably, maybe today, put on reserve the four-volume thing that's been my main source by Menachem Elam, which is a modern one, Mishpat Ivri, I think is the title, but it's in English. And it certainly tells me a lot of stuff Maimonides doesn't, about, you know, where it comes from and the history and all sorts of other stuff. But if I actually wanted to figure out what the law was on something, I think it would be much less useful than Maimonides would be, because he really is writing, I think, what's intended as a book that a judge can use to figure out what the law is and that individual parties can use. I'm making a contract with you. I want to know what contracts I can legally make and under what circumstances they're enforceable against you. You know, I'm getting married. I want to know what the rules are on marriage and all of that sort of stuff. So I found it, at least. I don't know if I have a link to it, but if you check on my blog and do a search for Maimonides... Did I say about there's this old story which I decided was just a watered down version of the original story. And in my version of the story, the young
young peasant who's trying to learn the law goes to the rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, this is terrible. I've been trying to read Maimonides and it's much too complicated for me for the following days. What should I do?" And the rabbi says, "My son, do you know somebody who has a volume of the Mishnah?" And he says, "Well, yes, my uncle has a volume. Just read that and come back to me in a week." And he comes back and he says, "Oh, Rabbi, this Mishnah is dreadful." He gives one answer to this question and one answer to that question and a third answer from another rabbi to the other question, and I can make no sense of it. "Do you know somebody who has a volume of the Talmud?" "Yes, I have somebody." Goes and eats the Talmud. And says, "Oh, Rabbi, this compared to this, the Mishnah was simple. I mean, you know, they not only give one IQ answers to this, but you've got somebody who says, but the reason why Rabbi so and so said this is the following, and he was really agreeing with Rabbi such and such, but no, or you might say, no, the reason he said it was that it's just awful. Go back and read Maimonides." "Oh, Rabbi, Maimonides is so clear and easy." And that was my response. As some of you may know, the original story is the one where the peasant is complaining about how his house is too crowded, and the rabbi asks him, "Do you have a cow?" "Yes, put the cow into the house." And he goes through sort of week by week, as it gets worse and worse, put in the goat, put in the chickens, and so forth, and finally, you know, take them all out of the house. "Oh, Rabbi, the house is so spacious and quiet and pleasant." So I figured that I preferred my original version, which no doubt this is just the watered down for non-scholars approach. Anyway, all right. Other questions, either on next week's assignment or just on the stuff you've been looking at so far. I was discussing some of this stuff online with somebody who obviously was a believer, and he gave me a great line, which probably wasn't original with him, which is a way of responding to the question, do these people really believe in this, given that you've got all these rules and then all these ways of getting around the rules you don't like? And his answer was, "The perfect one who made the law also made the loopholes." All right, and you can see how somebody could actually believe it. That is why the argument would be, look, not even God could write a clear, unambiguous law code, which would be the right answer to all questions at all times and places. So the best God can do is to write a fairly clear and unambiguous legal code, but to insert in it a few loopholes, which will let, when it's clear that it's giving the wrong answer, let people change it for that purpose. So that the loopholes, one loophole is this statement that if you're in doubt about what the law is, accept the view of the majority. And here this means the majority of the legal scholars pretty clearly is how they interpret it, at least. And that becomes more or less a blank check for, first, for interpreting things, and second, for legislating, for explicit legislation, for things where the authorities know perfectly well that Torah doesn't say this, but they say this is nonetheless what we should do. If you look sort of at the power that you might think of as the court or the halakhic authorities, or initially the Sanhedrin, who was an actual official court legislature made up of halakhic authorities, and later it's a sort of a vaguer majority opinion of the scholars kind of thing. And the bit I was just, the first bit which says if you're in doubt, you know, believe the majority, is a blank check for interpretation. All right, and now I might say, but I wasn't in doubt. It was perfectly clear what the thing said. No, you're in doubt. You're in doubt, my son. Let us tell you what the right answer is. And the one which I looked up in a little more detail, the discussion of killing disobedient sons. Actually, I should have brought the volume with me so I could give you an exact quote from the Bible, but it's something along the lines of, if you have a son who is disobedient and disrespectful to his parents and will not reform when you tell him to, let his mother and his father lead him out, take him by the hand and lead him to the court and say to the court, this is our son who is a drunkard and I remember the list. I'm missing some of it anyway. He was a glutton and a drunkard, and he will not heed our voice, therefore stone him to death. And what are the restrictions that various of the authorities read into this? Well, to begin with, in order for this to happen, the mother and the father have to do this, so you've got to have both parents alive. Well, that's not too hard. But next, they can't be blind, because if they were blind, they couldn't say, this is my our son, because how could they know for sure it was the right person? And they can't be crippled, because if they were crippled, how could they lead him to the court? And they can't be mute. They've got to be able to talk in order that they can say to the court these things. And they can't be deaf. I don't remember why they can't be deaf, but there's some part of the instructions they couldn't do if they were deaf. Furthermore, some authorities hold that since it says that the father and mother say this, they've got to say it with one voice. That requires that their voices are identical, their appearance is identical, and their height is identical, none of which is very likely. And then finally, various authorities say, well, look, you couldn't hold a minor to be liable for these offenses. So he's got to be at least 13 years and a day, which is the age of majority. On the other hand, you couldn't hold an adult who's no longer, his legally speaking, as it were, his parent's son, to be liable, and at least some of them seem to say at 13 and 3 months he's an adult. So you've only got 3 months in which you can get him. And Maimonides, I think it was, as I think I mentioned last time, goes into more details on that limit, and his limit is, I think it was 6 months, but maybe it's 3 months. But it's basically the point at which it is logically possible that the son could be a father. And at that point he doesn't classify as a son, so he can't apply this rule to him. And so the result is that they all agree this is never going to happen. And I've got to look up, because I think it's in Maimonides, I couldn't find it in my secondary source, the explanation of why God would make a rule for something that's never going to be applied. But there is an explanation somewhere, which is to say, I have forgotten. So that sort of is one of the examples, though by no means the only example. There are quite a lot of others. Some of them are ones where it's not that they're really trying to violate the rule, they're trying to find a more detailed rule than is really in the text. So that they say, well, look, it says do this and do this. The first do this must mean such and such, and the second do this must mean that. And there are a lot of things like that where they're drawing out a whole lot of detail, and they're saying, you know, the following incident occurs in the Old Testament, and that tells us that the legal rule is such and such. And so a bunch of that stuff really is interpretation. They see it as interpretation, not legislation, but it's very fine-drawn interpretation. And insofar as there's an excuse, it's this claim of the oral Torah, that there is a oral tradition of what all this means that's been passed down to them. I'm not sure to what extent they believe that, and to what extent what they really believe is God authorized us to interpret it, so any interpretation which has good results, we're entitled to make. I don't know, you'd have to ask a halakhic authority. So what about, that's interpreting Torah. What about changing Torah? What about the case where you explicitly are saying the rule in Torah is such and such, but here is our rule? And they clearly know they're doing that, because you've got all sorts of references to Torah law versus rabbinic law. And rabbinic law is where the Sanhedrin or later authorities basically say, we're going to make a rule which isn't actually in the Torah. Why? We're hedging the Torah around. We're making rules forbidding you from getting close to violating a rule in the Torah. For example, there could be a variety. There are a considerable variety. And one reason, some of the time, is they say, look, there are cases where if we didn't make this rule, things worse than making this rule would happen. So there's the argument that it is all right if you have to change one letter in Torah in order to keep the whole thing from being destroyed. And it's all right to violate one Sabbath in order to preserve many Sabbaths. So I presume, I don't know where that particular quote comes from except that I saw it, but I presume that if we say, look, if we don't do something forbidden by law on the Sabbath, because on the Sabbath you're not supposed to work, and work's got this elaborate definition, but the Romans are besieging us, we'll all die if we don't, you know, rebuild the walls on Saturday, because they're going to attack Saturday evening, so therefore better that we violate one Sabbath and that we never have any more Sabbaths again. And it's tricky, because there are cases where they don't take that kind of position. There's in particular a rather complicated case about the situation where the Gentiles come to a bunch of Jews and they say, give us one of your members to kill. And the opinion, at least that I was looking at, and I think it's from Maimonides, but I'm not sure, is that if they say, choose one of your members and give us to him to kill, you don't do it, even though they're going to kill all of you if you don't. If they say, give us Simon to kill, you're allowed to give him Simon to kill. That you're not, that the Jewish group is not allowed to choose one of them to be killed. And I think the same thing if they're asking for a woman to rape, as I remember, I think there's a parallel case for that. So there clearly are cases where you are supposed to abide by the rules even though the results are catastrophic, but there are other cases where you're expected to modify the rules in order to... Yeah.
That makes sense, psychologically, because then if they identify who it is, and that's very helpful, and there's not expenditure of resources...
Could be. It could be. Yeah, you could argue that we're worried about the fact that if we chose the person, then after it's all over, his kin will be furious at us, and maybe he'll try to run away, and we'll have to choose someone else, and think of all sorts of things. Yeah, but I don't think one knows. I mean, I think that would be a big... I mean, my feeling at this point is that when I've taught this course two or three more times, then I actually understand Jewish law. And at that point, one could start seriously trying to analyze it, figure out how much it made sense. Parts of it surely do make sense, other parts I'm not sure of. But in any case, there was some argument as to whether the halakhic authorities were entitled both to cancel positive obligations and to permit things forbidden by obligations. So on the one hand, there is a positive obligation to do certain ceremonial things on certain days. And the general opinion was that if the halakhic authorities say there's a reason why we can't do it, they're allowed to do that. And I think there's some example which I think is a case where you've got a clash between two rules, where there's something that you have to do on a certain day and that you can't do on the Sabbath, and that day might happen on the Sabbath, I'm not sure. But the general accepted rule seems to have been that the authorities could make rules saying the Torah says you must do X, but for the following special reason you must do X. And there was dispute as to whether the halakhic authorities could say the Torah says you may not do X, but you can do X anyway for the following special reasons. And the general conclusion seems to have been that they couldn't. Although if you sort of follow the story down another 500 or 1,000 years, in effect they're doing it. But that there clearly was a good deal more reluctance to let you do forbidden things than to let you off from doing supposedly mandatory things. Now, one very powerful power which they agreed that the court, which was basically only the halakhic authorities, did have, and that then gets passed on to the community, is the authority to expropriate property, to say that's no longer yours. And it turns out, part of the interesting thing about this is that authority can be used in various ways that really amount to avoiding positive obligations of Torah. So that, for example, one that gets mentioned is that if you were planting forbidden plants, which I think in this case are hybrids, if I've got it right, but I'm not sure, the court could expropriate those plants. And fine, that's, you know, a way of enforcing the rule. But now let us suppose that I am growing forbidden plants, and I have not yet paid the tithe on them, the 10% that is supposed to go to the Levites, or the second 10% that goes somewhere else, and the court expropriates them. Well, they're not mine anymore. In fact, they're nobody's anymore. But what the court is doing is not seizing it for themselves, but saying you no longer own it. Well, there are all these plants sitting here which nobody owns, and you're allowed to take found property if you want to. So, assuming I'm the first guy who shows up, and obviously the court seriously trying to enforce the rules will try to keep this from happening, but I find this property. Well, you know, you only have to pay tithe on stuff you grow. Found property, you're not obliged to a tithe on that. So apparently the legal opinion was that in that hypothetical case, you get out of paying the tithe because the property stops being yours prior to your being obliged to the tithe and then becomes yours in a fashion in which it's not encumbered by the obligation. That would be one example. But another and more important example is prosper. Because one of the rules of Torah is that a whole bunch of things happen every 7 years. There are even more extreme things that happen, I think, on the 50th year, if I remember correctly, that's the Jubilee. And on the 50th year, well, I guess on the 7th year, Jewish slaves are freed. Canaanite slaves, which basically mean any non-Jewish slaves, I'm not sure if they're freed on the 50th year. They might be freed before that. But also on the 7th year, all debts are canceled. And on the 7th year, some of the really weird stuff, which I don't understand, you're not really supposed to cultivate your land. So how you eat, I don't know. Whether you're supposed to have stored up food or something. I suppose that does give the land a rest, but it seems a little bit stringent. But in any case, one result that was clearly predicted by the authors of Torah is that on the sixth year, people are going to be very reluctant to lend money, because I lend you 1,000 shekels, and seventh year comes around, and you've got 1,000 shekels, and you don't owe me anything. And so Hillel the Elder, the originator, I think, of the school of Hillel that I was discussing, invents this thing called prosbul, and there's some dispute as to where the name comes from. It's Greek, ultimately, as they guess. And the prosbul is a procedure by which you go to the court and you say, and you arrange for the court to free your the loan you're making from the seventh year obligation. And I guess what's going on is the court can transfer property, so the court says, all right, you're a debtor. I've just transferred 1,000 shekels of yours to that guy, payable on the seventh year, on the eighth year, or something of that sort. So in fact, it was a legal mechanism whose real effect was that you could make laws ignoring the seventh year. When I said the people who wrote, whoever wrote the Torah interpreted it, the Torah warns against refusing to make loans as the seventh year is approaching, that you ought to be generous to your neighbor. But presumably Hillel had a more realistic view of how generous people were likely to be there to their neighbors. And their, yeah.
Did Hillel participate in writing of the Mishnah?
No, I'm almost sure the Mishnah is well after a couple of centuries, I think, after Hillel. I'd have to, again, I may be wrong, but I think that's right. Hillel, the Mishnah is somebody, Hanazi, I forget his first name, believed to be the author of that. And I think Hillel was, I think, before that, but I'd have to, again, I'd have to look more carefully. You've got a period when the effective rule is in pairs of religious authorities, and I have a feeling, though, I like, you know, the chief priest and the second priest, and I have a feeling Hillel is one of those. But in any case, I'm almost sure that Mishnah has a bunch of stuff where it says, and the school of Shammai said this, and the school of Hillel said that, and the school of Shammai said, but the reason for our position is, and the school of Hillel agreed, and that pretty clearly is happening well after the founding of the school.
Was it ever enunciation of the Mishnah?
The Mishnah Torah? You mean Maimonides?
Right.
This is much later than you realize. This is 1,000 years later.
Was it you think it was motivated by
I don't think so. No, mostly he agrees with it. There are places where he says, my teachers say such and such, but I think it's wrong for the following reasons. But those are a fairly small minority of the situations. And I think what he saw himself as doing was taking an existing tradition of taking the Talmud and a bunch of post-Talmudic stuff that had been going on in the diaspora since then, because it's not like that nothing happens between the Torah and the Talmud, or between the Talmud and Maimonides. And I think what he sees himself as doing is just taking it and reducing it to a clear, comprehensible form, and no doubt a really serious scholar will want to go back to the original sources. I think there's some suggestion that he may have contemplated at some point writing a second book that would explain the reasons for all the views, for all the conclusions he gave in Mishnah Torah. But if he contemplated that, it never happened.
So
that's right. It's a restatement treatise. Like the restatement, it has no legal authority, but it persuades people. I mean, that's what restatements do, basically. Yeah. Now, remember, this is happening at a point when there really is no Jewish government to convince. There are a whole, by the 12th century, the authority of the Geonim, of the Babylonian Academy leaders, has more or less evaporated. You've got a bunch of dispersed communities. Many, perhaps most of these communities have judicial autonomy. As many of the communities, the Gentile sovereign has said, you're in charge of any crime committed by a Jew against a Jew. You're in charge of any litigation between a Jew and a Jew. We expect to get the following amount of taxes each year out of your community, collecting them as your problem, not our problem. And we will enforce your verdicts. I mean, the thing that I found most extraordinary, and I want to find someone who knows more than I do who can tell me if I've got it right, is that in this later period, one of the capital crimes was informing. And informing meant telling the Gentile authorities things about a fellow Jew that got him into trouble. All right? This is a capital offense, and it's the Gentile authorities who cut people's heads off. So it looks as though you have this situation where the court of the Jewish community goes to the king, basically, and says, hey, king, we've got this guy who's been telling you secrets about our people. That's a capital offense. And he says, all right, call out the headsman, cut his head off. Which seems very bizarre, and I'm not sure I've got it right, but that's the stuff I'm going to be saying.
What was it, a criticism of the previous rabbinic traditions? Why was it so controversial when it was published?
Because I think the main controversy was whether you ought to have a plain statement of conclusions as opposed to what the Talmud and even the Mishnah had been, which was a statement of arguments. That is, I think, as far as I can tell, the real controversy was not mainly over the conclusions, that is to say that there were people, of course, who disagreed in detail, right? People, even people who said, yes, he's got it mostly right, still said, but in order to be a judge, you should know not merely what Maimonides thinks the rule was, but what that past scholar and this past scholar and so forth thinks it was. Now, I should say, they do have something sort of analogous to stare decisis. And that's the rule that, I don't know who the names are, but it's something like Simon and his generation is as great an authority as someone in his. Meaning, whoever the latest halakhic authorities are, they get to decide what our rules are, even if we don't think they're as learned as the people 500 years ago who said something differently. But I think the real argument was about whether you ought to have a plain statement of conclusions or whether you ought to have something more like Mishnah or Talmud. Because after all, people are going to, I mean, no one in his right mind is going to read the Talmud once he's got Maimonides. And you could see that would be a problem, be seen as a problem. And then you have the imposing criminal punishments, which can be inconsistent with the rules in Torah, that you can punish people who have not, under religious law, done anything that incurs that punishment. And as I say, there's sort of two of the arguments that are offered. One of them is a fence around the Torah, one of them which just says we not only can't do things that are forbidden by Torah, we don't want to let people get close to doing things that are forbidden by Torah, so we'll make broader rules just to make sure. And the other one which gets in is the claim that the necessities of the time require it, that terrible things will happen if we don't bend the rules in this direction so we can bend the rules. And part of that is what are referred to as temporary measures, which are required to maintain the faith. And the analogy is to amputating your hand if you've got to save your life, that kind of thing. And one of the ones that's discussed, to some extent under that, goes back to the problem of the wife whose husband has disappeared. Because under religious law, as you take Torah strictly, you need two witnesses to testify to somebody's death. And if they haven't proved that he's dead, then she can't remarry. And the position was taken fairly early that in this case, if the wife herself testified the husband was dead, that was enough. And part of the argument was some real incident involving the early sages where a woman says, you know, my husband was bit by a snake and died, and they check, and there are other witnesses, and yes, indeed, she's telling the truth, and this somehow is evidence that women tell the truth about this thing. You might say, well, there are other witnesses. But eventually, both schools agree. I think this is one of the ones where Shammai convinces Hillel that, in general, a woman can testify to that by herself, and it'll count. And there is the argument that says, look how much trouble she's going to get into if the husband later shows up. So that's why she won't tell a lie about this. But I think the other argument pretty clearly is otherwise we're going to have cases of women who spend the rest of their life unable to be married and have kids and do the things we want women to be doing just because they were the only witness. Now this doesn't solve the problem which still exists where there's no witness. That is where the wife, in fact, doesn't know her husband went off, you know, on a voyage and he never came back and we don't have witnesses to say what happened to him, and I think that's still a problem. I don't know. You should check whether they've invented some newer way of getting around that one. But again, executing an informer, you have the argument that informers are basically a lethal threat to the community, and therefore, even though under religious law we can't execute them, both because the offense is not mentioned in the religious law, and because if it were, there are these very stringent requirements before you can execute anybody for anything, we've got to be able to execute them in order to protect ourselves, so we do it anyway. And the question of what temporary, there's a discussion in the Menachem Ilan book of what temporary means. And temporary doesn't mean temporary. That is to say, you may have a temporary measure which there is no reason to expect to ever stop. And what at least he interprets that it really means is that it's viewed as a sort of a second-class law. It has less authority than would, I guess, either ordinary rabbinic law or especially Torah. And I guess that might mean that it would be easier for other later people to change it or to make rules inconsistent with it. I'm not quite sure. But somehow it's seen as if you do this kind of thing, you've got to say it's a temporary measure. And that tells people what its status is. And again, I'm not sure I fully understand what's going on there, but I think it's some of what I described. Alright, so far I've been talking about the halakhic authorities, because you've basically got, you've got Torah, and you then have the religious scholars who initially are organized into the Sanhedrin, and they are both interpreting the law and making what they see as new legislation within certain constraints of how far they can go against the divinely revealed law. And then by around the 10th century, the Sanhedrin's been out of business for 500 years or so, maybe a little bit more than that. The Geonim, who are the heads of the Babylonian academies, are for whatever reason beginning to lose their influence over other people in the diaspora. And any particular community making its own rules may or may not have any halakhic authorities. And you could say, you know, what's the majority of the halakhic authority? Well, zero out of zero. And at that point, you're getting an increasing importance around the end of the 10th century to communal authorities, to basically the equivalent of the mayor and the city council of the Jewish community. And there is, in the previous law, it is accepted there are some things that those authorities can do. So there are examples earlier than that where the sages are saying, yes, the community can fix the prices of products in the marketplace and several other things they can do. But increasingly, from late 10th century on, the communal authorities are in effect replacing the court of the halakhic authorities. Halakha is a legal rule, so halakhic authorities are basically, you know, legal scholars, loosely speaking. And as far as I can tell by this time, there isn't any diploma. That is, there is a period which I think pretty much ends with the second revolt against the Romans, which is, what, I think second century or so. Prior to that, there's actually a procedure which you sort of officially become a halakhic authority, officially become a scholar. Name which I've now forgotten. And that goes out of use. That has to be done in Israel, and I think the Romans are sort of preventing it, and so it goes out of use. You've got the equivalent, as it were, of the apostolic succession problem. That in order to be given a diploma, you've got to be somebody who's got a diploma to give it to you. There aren't any of them. And the Romans killed the last one or something, so what do we do? And from then on, as far as I can tell, all you really have are people who other people see as good sources of information, as learned in the law. And there's clearly a hierarchy of that, but it's a hierarchy of reputation, not of formal position. You know, somebody in Germany says, well, you know, this guy Maimonides just knows more about the law than anybody else, so we should accept his view on it. Or doesn't say that. That's up to them. So in any case, the communal authorities are becoming important. And they feel free to make civil law, to make public law, things like how you allocate the tax burden within the community, and a good deal of criminal law. And the position of the halakhic authorities is that with regard to mammon, with regard to things that are not religious rules, the communal authorities, in effect, are the court. They have the same authority as the halakhic authorities would if there were halakhic authorities to make the decisions. On the other hand, they cannot, for example, permit usury, permit loans at interest, because the rule against loans at interest is a religious rule, is seen as a religious rule. It might seem to us like an ordinary part of, you know, the material world, but it isn't. Can they imprison debtors? And that gets a little tricky. And the answer initially is they probably can't. And then sort of things get pushed as the centuries go on. And you have a situation where the community, I think in Spain, says we're going to imprison debtors. And they go to there is a local religious scholar. And he initially says, no, you can't. And they say, well, we really have to because commerce isn't going to go on if we can't make people pay their debts. And eventually the position he comes to is if you believe the debtor has the money to pay the debt, you can imprison him. And I think, if I understand it, the view is you aren't punishing him for not paying the debt, you're compelling him to pay the debt, if you think about that difference. All right, does that make sense? That it is, as soon as he pays the debt, you let him out. So this is really a way of forcing him to do something he's obliged to do. And the position then is that if you really believe that the debtor doesn't have the money, you aren't allowed to imprison him. And this, of course, is a tension in other systems. If you think of it as,
Well, that's the criminal-civil contempt of court distinction.
That's interesting.
Contempt is to punish or to coerce. And if it's to coerce, then it can go on indefinitely, provided that the coercion could coerce.
That's interesting.
We said, I'm never going to rat on my partner or whatever, then it wouldn't any longer be a coercion.
So we're civil and criminal, because I don't know this distinction. Which is which?
Criminal would be if you violated the consent order and you gave it a definite punishment. But the civil would be if the jailhouse keys are in the person's hands, he can pay the debt and get out.
Right.
Then it's civil.
Right. So if I think of the story where the judge is trying to get the slightly deaf lawyer to shut up, and the deaf lawyer doesn't hear him and keeps talking, and the judge says, $10 for contempt of court. And the lawyer looks at him and says, what do you say, Your Honor? $10 for contempt of court. I'll pay it now. It's a just debt. That's the version in which it's a punishment. Whereas the version where they say, you have refused to give us the key to the encryption that's got your documents that we want as evidence, we're going to lock you up until you do, that's the civil. Right. Got it. All right. Yeah, right. Right, yes. Yeah, well, clearly they've got that distinction because, as we'll come to later, you've got the same thing with regard to divorce, where you punish a man in order to make him divorce his wife. The court, however, can still transfer property, and you can often indirectly get your isur, your religious things, by appropriate transfers of property. And the court, when it is acting according to communal enactments, is not bound by the rules of Torah. So that, for example, it can allow people to be witnesses who are related to some of the parties and therefore are explicitly forbidden under Torah. It can impose punishments that Torah doesn't allow to punishment. It can convict you of a capital offense without the evidence that Torah says you have to commit a capital offense, and so forth. And one of the arguments that's made, there are a couple of arguments made to defend this, and one of the arguments is, look, the Gentile authorities have given us the power to enforce criminal law against our own people. If we don't do what they see as a satisfactory job, they're going to take it away again, and then we're really in trouble. So therefore, since if we follow the strict Torah rules, even though we know perfectly well that Simon is a murderer, Maimonides tells us that even if a man is pursuing his enemy into a house with a knife in his hand, and he comes out with covered with blood and his enemy is there stabbed and dead, that's not enough evidence to convict him of murder. Well, if we work on those principles, the king is not going to leave us in authority over our murderers, because then people know that he murderers running around free. So that's an argument. And then the final argument, which it's not clear how important it was, but clearly exists, is that the communal authorities are in effect the heir of the king of Israel. That back when there was a kingdom, the king had his own courts and punishments separate from the religious court, and those rules we see in the Old Testament, kings doing things that clearly they are not permitted under Torah, therefore the king could do it, so now the nearest thing we have to a king is the city councilor, or the equivalent of the city council there. And I mentioned a little bit the particular case of marriage law, where there are various rules. For example, if you carry a woman off, and she then decides, yes, indeed, she likes you and is willing to marry you, as long as she is really consenting at the point when you marry her, under Torah, it's a valid marriage. But various of the communal authorities don't much like that idea because men don't want their daughters carried off. Among other things, it might be a way of evading the father's control, or people have their reasons as well. So therefore, some of the communal authorities say, no, that's not valid, and you've got to have 10 witnesses and a rabbi present, and so forth and so on. And then the question is, well, how can they do that? Isn't that Isur? Isn't that religious law? And one solution, which I mentioned before, which I like, is sort of a particularly outrageous bit of getting around the law, is, but the wedding ring is mammon, the wedding ring is material property, we will confiscate the wedding ring in some sense before the wedding. How we do that, if you don't know what's happening, I don't know, but we're going to do it retroactively if need be. Since he didn't own the wedding ring, it wasn't a valid wedding. Since it wasn't a valid wedding, they aren't married. And at least Elon's, my modern secondary sources view, is that people were uncomfortable with that. And part of the problem probably is that we're talking about now a world where there's no single Jewish legal authority. So what happens is that our authority says she isn't really married for that reason, and she goes off to another town and marries somebody, and that town says, what are you doing? You, the husband, are committing adultery because this woman is still married. After all, under religious law, she was married. And given that, that and maybe other considerations, they're reluctant to follow out this long line, although it is used. And the alternative method which avoids those problems is to say, all right, if we believe that the marriage shouldn't have been legitimate, yes, it was legitimate under religious law, but we're going to grab the husband, since husbands can divorce their wives, we're going to lock him up until he divorces his wife, or beat him if necessary until he divorces his wife. So that's the same approach as the debt imprisonment, as it were. It's not that we're punishing him for breaking our rules, it's just we have the right to lock people up if we want to, and we're going to do it for this purpose, and it's a good purpose, so it's all right. So once he's actually divorced her, now under religious law that we all agree on, she's free to marry somebody else. So that's one possibility. Let me go on to something which isn't really about specifically communal versus the other, but it's a line of doctrine that goes from Torah on, and that's the question of how you transfer stuff, how you buy and sell, how you deal with property. And that's sort of interesting, because it turns out that the original biblical rule is that when I pay you the money, the stuff is mine, and I don't have to take possession. I was mistaken in that. The requirement that I take physical possession of stuff for it to be mine is a rabbinic rule that then gets imposed by these same people who are adding their own legislation to improve things. And that under, there are some other requirements under the biblical rules. There are very various other ways you can get property, and various special ceremonies. If it's family property, you've got to sort of ceremonially renounce that the previous owner has to, and so forth. But the argument that gets made vis-a-vis the later requirement that stuff isn't yours until you take possession of it, that argument is basically the same one that we discussed in the context of law in Taiwan, namely, if you buy it from me, it's now yours, but I've still got it. Now there's a fire in my warehouse and it's destroyed. I claim that's your loss. I get to keep the money because it was your property, but I'm not going to have an adequate incentive to protect that property if I know that it's going to be your loss. So the rule is going to be that until you've taken it, it's mine, and therefore I'll have to give you back the money. You see that in a somewhat different context, taking it a little step farther, in Maimonides, where the doctrine is that if you sell me something and I take possession of it and I haven't paid you the money yet, it's still mine. And if I never pay you the money, I owe you the money, but not the thing. So that could matter, again, if you imagine the thing has been changed or destroyed or something during that period. So at that point, first, let me go back a step, because there's a different point which is sort of relevant to that. And that is that in this legal system, there's a close connection between contract and property. Because if I lend you money, that is establishing a lien by me on your property. the equivalent of a mortgage, but automatically. And it changes over time which of your property, that there are some contexts in which it's got to be your worst land is all I can claim unless you run out of worst land and then I get the better land. And I think initially it's only your land and not your movable property, and later it switches to being your movable property in first priority and then your land. And the argument, I think, is that in the early period, first, most of the wealth was land, and second, I know where your land is, I can grab that, your movable property you could be hiding. But in any case, the sort of ground rule is that obligations are backed up by claims against property. And so it now matters how we handle claims against property. And the problem with a rule that says that in order for you to sell me something, I've got to be able to draw it into my possession is what if it's not there? In the extreme case, what if it doesn't exist yet? But I'll get to that later. But if you just imagine the case where we're part of a network of traders over an area of 1,000 miles or so, and you know you've got this caravan load of some of silk that's come from China, and you need some money, and you want me to sell it to me, but I can't draw it into my possession. And then there are a number of different solutions that they later come up with. One of them is simply the idea that as long as one half of the transaction occurs, as long as you can draw into your possession the bag of gold I'm paying for it, now the transaction is complete. So I've got your distant property. And that eventually becomes a symbolic barter in the sense that even if what you're really paying for me also isn't currently available to be transferred, as long as there's something, a handkerchief is this traditional thing you do it with, for which I gather sudar is the Hebrew word. So the transfer by sudar is that you give me a handkerchief and I say I'm taking this handkerchief in exchange for my caravan load of silk out there. But by the way, of course, you're also taking something from me in exchange for the pile of gold, which you is also not here yet, which you're going to pay me with. So it's a system in which you're having symbolic barter. And there's then a variant on that, and I haven't figured out what the advantage of it or why anybody does it, which has to do with the fact that when you transfer land, along with the land, you transfer anything connected with the land. And I actually have a discussion in my Law and Econ book, which was written long before I knew any of this stuff, about ways in which in common law one might be able to evade certain restrictions by connecting things with land. So the argument I have there is that one of the, if you think about our law, one of the special things about real property is that you can rebundle the rights. So I can sell you a piece of land while maintaining an easement to cross it, or while selling him the license to hunt game on it in February or something. I can't really do the equivalent with other kinds of property. That if I sell you the example that I like, which actually is an example that gets back to Jewish law, I suppose I am so ultra-Orthodox that not only do I believe that I shouldn't work on the Sabbath, I believe my car shouldn't work on the Sabbath. And that's true even after I've sold the car. So I sell the car to you on the terms that you agree not to drive it on the Sabbath. Now that is a contract I can presumably enforce against you. But you then sell the car to her, and you don't tell her anything about this, she signs no such contract. I can sue her for violating the contract by passing it on without the restriction, but there's no way I can stop the car from being procured on a Sabbath. If it were a piece of land, I could. Because if it was a piece of land, the restriction, the license, or the easement runs with the land, and therefore goes to whoever buys the land. Does that distinction make sense to all of you? So it occurred to me, well, under ordinary property law, you can include with land, you can add to the bundle of land other things like the obligation to draw to buy water from your neighbor's well, or the obligation to, well, why couldn't you take the car, somehow add it to the land so that you have a bundle which includes ownership of the land plus the car, now rebundle it by an easement which covers the car, and now sell it. And that's the secretary of this screwy idea, but that logically seemed possible if you say you can rebundle land, and rebundling includes adding other stuff to the land. Well, it turns out my ancestors 500,000 years ago thought of a version of this idea too, because what you could do was to say, I can transfer land by the following procedure, I remember what it was, and I can associate other property with that land. It doesn't actually have to be sitting on the land, so therefore I can give you sell you a little tiny piece of land of no importance, along with my caravan full of silk that's 1,000 miles away, and you now have them both. And if I don't have any land at all, which by the time this is happening is not unlikely, because in the diaspora, Jews were in various ways restricted from owning land. If I have no land at all, that's all right. Every Jew owns a per capita share of the land of Israel, and I can transfer my share to you, along with the caravan full of silk. And maybe you'll transfer it back to me if you're feeling nice later, so I can do it again. So anyway, you've got these various sort of odd ways of first imposing the restriction that you take possession for a not unreasonable reason, and then as you develop into more of a commercial culture, finding different ways of working around that to make it easier. And as I was going to say, one of the problems is that you can't transfer stuff that doesn't exist. And that comes in a religious context where you can't consecrate something to the temple if it doesn't exist yet. And Maimonides says, that's all right, because oaths are binding. So what you can do is say, well, I can't give you this property or guarantee that this property will be available to be spent on redeeming captives, which is one of the examples he gives. But I can swear an oath saying that when I get possession of this property, say land I'm going to inherit when my father dies or something, that when I get possession of the property, I will dedicate it to this purpose, and oaths are binding. And therefore, you can effectively make a contract for a not yet existent or not yet in your possession object, which is very useful if you think about a real commercial society where you may want to make contracts for what you're going to do next year or deliver next year or whatever. I discussed a little bit last time as another still running version of getting around things, expanding the Eruv, the idea that certain of the Sabbath restrictions don't apply as long as you stay within your courtyard. There is a definition, which I think you can probably even find in Maimonides, to what counts as a courtyard, and with a little ingenuity you can turn large chunk of the south end of Manhattan Island into one courtyard, and now you can move around within that area on the Sabbath without move around, carry stuff. I think the restriction, if I've got it correctly, is that I can carry stuff within my house. And, you know, I can pick up something and move it, but I'm not supposed to be carrying burdens sort of out in public. But got a bunch of houses facing on one courtyard, that counts as within the house if I'm doing with that. Fine. Make symbolic boundaries around very large courtyards, and now we can carry stuff on the side. Yep?
There's a similar problem at the library in the neighborhood where I used to live. It was heavily Jewish populated. It was electric doors and electric escalator to get into the main library.
So what happened?
I don't know how they resolved it, but it was a
yes.
thing to do about
Yes, of course. Yeah, yes. Now, the rules are moderately complicated. For example, it is perfectly legal, as I understand it, for an Orthodox Jew to make a pot of stew on Friday before Sabbath begins, to leave the stove on a low setting with the stew bubbling on it, and, you know, eat it on the Sabbath.
You can't turn it on or off.
That's right. That having the electricity flowing through and heating it does not count as work. Somehow it's a change in state that counts as work. Now, presumably driving a car, you keep on having that spark plug go, so I assume that driving a car would count even if you never turn the engine off, which gets sort of expensive in the fuel. I think it would still probably count as work. But again, part of what's sort of in a way entertaining about all this is you've got very smart people devoting a whole lot of energy to figuring out how to apply these elaborate rules from 2,500 years ago to a modern society. As I mentioned before, one of the problems in Jewish law is also in... I wonder if what's happening with this recorder is that it's showing me how much memory I've got left, and that's why it's running down instead of up this time. That would be all right. Once I get back to my computer, I can plug this silly thing into the USB port and go erase all my surplus talks, but I just haven't bothered to erase, which is why I didn't realize it was running out of memory, but it was, apparently. Anyway, so you have these rules against lending at usury, and if you look at one of the relevant chunk of the Maimonides stuff we've got on reserve, he has a discussion of various cases where you have contractual arrangements that on the face of them are legitimate, but which he thinks you shouldn't do because they involve implicitly usury. And then there is a distinction between sort of the literal usury, which is violating Torah, and then these other things which are violating rules of the sages, which are violating the fence around Torah, which is bad but not as bad. And I think what's going on, but it may be with the second category, is that you aren't punished for making a loan at usury. It's just that you can only collect the principal, and if the borrower chooses not to pay the interest, you can't make him pay it. I think that's the rule, but I'm not positive. And in some sources that I don't have readily to hand, there's a discussion of contractual forms in which, in effect, it doesn't count as usury because the borrower could do something that would prevent paying interest, but he never does. And therefore, in fact, he's paying interest. And at least some people hold those to be legitimate. Some probably didn't. I want to talk a little bit more, something I mentioned before, about what I saw as the remnants of the feud system. And there are really two parts to that. The first is the whole business about the avenger of blood. And there, as I mentioned before, the rule seems to be that if you kill somebody, even by accident, his kinsman can now kill you. So what you have to do if you kill somebody is to go to one of the cities of refuge, and inside of the cities of refuge you're safe. You then are escorted back to the city where the killing occurred to be tried by a court. And I assume they can take you out of the city of refuge. I don't know if it's made explicit, but Maimonides probably says. If the court concludes that it was an accidental killing, they escort you back to the city of refuge, and you can live there until the high priest dies, which seems sort of an odd way of deciding it, at which point you're now a free man. You can go home, and I think nobody can kill you if I've got it right. However, at any point in this process, until you're in a city of refuge, the avenger of blood can legally kill you. So even if it was accidental, if it was not accidental, and if the court can prove it, the court's supposed to give you to the avenger of blood, and he kills you. And I'm not sure. I wonder if this is another way around the stringent requirements of proof for capital punishment. Because the argument might be, we, the court, aren't killing him. All we're doing is not stopping the avenger of blood from killing him, and then not punishing the avenger of blood. But in any case, but even if the court finds that it was accidental, if the avenger, as far as I know, if the avenger of blood manages to intercept the killer coming or to or going from the court, he can kill him with no legal penalty. And that sort of strikes me as how you modify an existing feud system where it was taken for granted that if you kill my kinsman, I can kill you. Well, we're going to try to set it up so that mostly it won't happen if it wasn't your fault, but we aren't going to push it very far. But the other case that actually started me thinking about this first, but it's related to that, is that there are a bunch of situations where the court, in effect, is letting the loss lie where it falls. And the kind of case, I think I discussed it in the thing that I had linked for you to read, is I lend you some money. And the document for the loan isn't very clear. And in one part it says I'm lending you 50 zuz, in another part it says I'm lending you 100 zuz. And you know, somebody made a mistake in the draft, and we don't know who. And the position of the court is that if you refuse to pay, they will compel you to pay me 50 zuz, because they are sure you owe me at least 50 zuz. They won't compel you to pay the 100 zuz. But if I have seized 100 zuz of your property, they won't make me give it back. Why won't they make me give it back? They also don't know that you don't owe me 100 zuz. All right, they're agnostic. They say you owe him something between 50 and 100 zuz. And our view is that we can only change the status quo if we're reasonably sure. Well, if he didn't pay me anything, they're reasonably sure that making him pay me 50 is something they're entitled to do. But if I took 100, they are not reasonably sure that making me give 50 of it back is something that they're entitled to do. And I thought it was really sort of neat. It seemed quite weird. I'm sure that with a little effort you could find analogous cases in our law, because you have, you know, burden of proof and beyond a shadow beyond a reasonable doubt and so forth. And I think the case that occurred to me, which isn't quite the same, but it's got the same feel to it, is where you're sure that a crime was committed by one of two people, but you have no way of knowing which. You can't punish either of them. And for that matter, I think there are cases where person A is convicted of receiving a bribe that person B is acquitted of paying, or maybe the other way around. So in that sense, you're getting an inconsistent result. And similarly, you could say this result is inconsistent because the court ought to decide whether it's 50 or 100, but in fact they don't. But again, if you step back from it and say, well, wait a minute, what's this business about people seizing property anyway? That looks an awful lot like the remnant of a legal system where when you had committed a tort against me or had failed to pay me money, my initial recourse wasn't to go to a court at all. My initial recourse was to say, all right, you owe me the value of 20 cows. I'm going to come on your property and walk off with 20 cows. Try to stop me. And that was particularly interesting to me because the next system we're going to look at is an Irish law system, which works exactly that way. I shouldn't say exactly, it's more elaborate than that. But the Irish law system, as far as I can tell, is one in which the way in which you vindicate your rights is normally by a seizure of property, by a very formal seizure of property, so that I have reason to claim that you owe me 20 cows, and I notify you with witnesses of the fact you owe me 20 cows, and you don't do anything about it, and now with witnesses I go on your property and I take 20 of your cows, and I drive them to some nice protected place on my land or on some third party's land, and guard them there, and you now have 3 days or something in which to pay me what you owed me, in which case you get your cows back. If you don't, sort of day by day, cows start forfeiting to me and become switched from being your property to being my property. And I don't fully understand